Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 273, and we're going to talk about 10 forgotten roads. They're just forgotten. I mean, you've heard of Route 66, but have you heard of the Lee Highway? We're also going to talk about troubleshooting a very difficult refrigerator problem, and it was weird. A product review of some spray-on rubber, because everybody needs some of that. And we're going to visit a museum filled with weird things, which is my favorite thing. Other than you, of course, you are my favorite thing, and thank you for joining me once again. So you have all heard of Route 66. You've heard the song. I prefer the Depeche Mode version myself, but to each his or her own. But Route 66 was not the first road. It may have been the mother road, but there were many, many, many American highways that were famous back in the day that Route 66 kind of took over the mantle from. But I'll bet you have not heard of all of them. You may have heard of a few of these, but there are 10 that I'm going to talk about that preceded Route 66 and yet were equally as important, if not as well traveled, which we will get into. But before I start talking about that, I want to introduce you to a gentleman by the name of Dr. Horatio Nelson Jackson. So he was a doctor in Vermont, and in 1903, he and his mechanic, who he hired to join him on this trip, hopped into a 20-horsepower Winton touring car, which he bought used, and drove all the way across the country. Now, it took him 63 days, 12 hours, and 30 minutes, and he drove all the way from San Francisco to New York City. It cost him $8,000 and 800 gallons of gasoline. That's $8,000 in 1903 money, about $250,000 today. And he did it for a bet. He bet somebody he could do it, and it was $50 he bet. And apparently the guy never paid up. The vehicle is actually sitting in the Smithsonian right now, where you can see it at the National Museum of American History. But the fascinating thing about this is he made this journey across 3,000 miles, and only 150 miles of those were paved. And that's not even true. It's actually that there were only 150 miles of paved roads in the entire country in 1903. So it's a remarkable achievement, but he did this because it seemed like such a crazy thing. Like, can you actually do this in a car? And he was the first one to do it. But we didn't have a whole lot of roads. We had trails. We had railways. We had ways to get across the country, but nothing like driving. Driving was something new. Cars had existed for a few decades, but they weren't normal or standard. And despite the conflict today between these two groups, it was actually bicycle enthusiasts who got together and helped develop the first roads in the country. And eventually they were joined by auto enthusiasts, and they formed what was called the Good Roads Movement. It was a grassroots advocacy campaign from the 1890s, and it took them 30 years to get momentum. But by that time, they started spreading across the country and building roads, trying to extol the virtues of good transportation. And finally, farmers got on board. They were like, wait, if we have good roads, we can take our goods to markets that are farther away, mail service will be quicker, etc., etc., etc. And some places started to realize that tourism would be enhanced if people could just drive instead of having to take six different trains to go 1,000 miles or whatever. And this whole movement started. There was a time where quote-unquote van life was encouraged in the United States, and towns and cities would build campgrounds for these people traveling along these highways. And I've encountered a bunch of them. I have actually stayed at some. I remember I was in Aurora, Illinois, which actually has one of these parks that's still been maintained by the city. No, you can't park there overnight now. But at one time, it was this big park, and you were supposed to park there with your vehicle overnight, and they had public cooking facilities, public restrooms, shelters, and you'd set up tents on the lawn, and this was encouraged. It's now not quite like that, but I've always found it to be a fascinating phenomenon. And as I'm driving around the country, I have this strategy where if I'm getting tired driving on the interstate, I will turn off the interstate and kind of follow the road that parallels the interstate, because there's almost always one. And I'm not talking about the frontage road, which is a fairly recent invention. I'm talking about the original either U.S. route or what William Leastheat Moon would call the blue highways, because on old maps they used to be blue in color rather than red. And I found that many of those roads would have names. And, well, let me tell you the story of 10 of these roads, because I think it's kind of fascinating. And by the way, while these routes don't technically exist anymore, you can follow these. If you're looking for an adventure to do some summer, you can pick any one of these roads and kind of follow them. For example, people still drive Route 66, even though it doesn't exist anymore. There are ways to do it, and sometimes you have to get on the more modern roads, but a lot of times you can stay on the old back roads that are still there. So, let me jump right in here with the one that I encounter the most often these days, which is the Lincoln Highway, which was officially opened in 1913. It was the first transcontinental highway. It stretched all the way from New York City to San Francisco, the same route that our Vermont doctor took earlier. And it was basically not a brand new road. They just decided the idea of a route was new. And what they did was they took a bunch of existing roads and kind of pasted them together to make a route, and they would fill in gaps where they needed to be. And car makers were heavily involved in this because obviously they wanted to sell more cars, and one way to sell more cars is to give people interest places to drive. And so over several years, they managed to build this rather remarkable highway. And it's still in there in a lot of places. In fact, if you're driving around, especially in the Midwest, and you see a red, white, and blue sign with an L on it, which I see fairly often, that is the Lincoln Highway. And a lot of the old gas stations and such are still there. It basically follows I-80, which I am not too far from right now as I sit recording this. And indeed, if I'm getting bored driving on I-80, I will often just take a turn and drive on the smaller roads for a while, and I will see Lincoln Highway's all signs all the time. I think driving the length of the Lincoln Highway would actually be a super interesting trip. Number two, the Bankhead Highway. This one was named for Alabama Senator John H. Bankhead. And this road connected Washington, D.C. to San Diego, but it went far south. This was the way to get from the Northeast, if you want to consider D.C. part of the Northeast. Some folks in New York might disagree with that. But it would take you down through the Deep South into Texas and the desert Southwest. And this was also part of this good roads movement that I mentioned earlier. And it was unique because unlike the San Francisco to New York Lincoln Highway, this one was almost all in rural areas. And many people saw their first cars as this road was being built. And, you know, they're sitting in their house. That house has been there for 30 years. They've always had horses and mules. And then this thing drives by. And people started to think, well, I could have a car like that someday. And, of course, then we have the Model T, et cetera, et cetera. Now, some of the Bankhead Highway is still there. A lot of this is missing. But you will see it in Texas, where it'll kind of be near I-10 and I-20. But there'll be signs that say SH1 or Old US 80. And some of the old buildings are there, some of the old gas stations, because part of them building these routes was to build support services as well. Number three, the Lee Highway. So the Lee Highway came about in the 1920s, and it was a response to the Lincoln Highway. After seeing the success of the Lincoln Highway, folks down south thought, why can't we have a road like this? This one connected from New York to San Francisco just like the Lincoln Highway, but instead of following the northerly route that is I-80 in this comparison, it went south, and it went through Virginia and Tennessee and Arkansas and Texas. Imagine going through Texas and then going to San Francisco. It was not necessarily a straight road. But it was at a time of conflict in the U.S., you know, this was a tumultuous period. It was about 100 years ago. Things were unsettled in the U.S. then, and we don't hear too much about that. But this is when the Confederate flag started to be flown as a symbol of Southern heritage. A lot of people think that just carried on from the Civil War, but in fact, it didn't. It came back at this time period. And this road tried to embrace that heritage, hence the Lee Highway, Robert E. Lee. And so this was considered the Southern route, you know, celebrating the Confederacy at a time of division and such. Not that we know what that is. Now it is part of US 11, US 29, and US 67. And in some of these towns, you'll see this road, the same road, repaved probably a dozen times, being used as the business routes for small towns. Number four, the Dixie Highway. This is a road I have been on many, many, many times. This road's very interesting. It was started in 1915, and rather than connecting coast to coast, it was designed to funnel money and people from the Midwest down into Florida. Florida tourism is well over 100 years old, and getting people down there was always the big challenge, you know. And before we had air travel, we had trains, and Flagler had his famous train down to Key West that a hurricane tore out. There's all kinds of history with that. But as soon as these long highways started to become feasible, Florida wanted in on the action. And so they connected a road from Chicago and Detroit, kind of like a Y. They would join up later, and it went all the way to Miami, with an eastern branch and a western branch. And this was a true tourist road. This one looked a lot more like Route 66. It had historic motels and barbecue stands, lots of neon signs later on. And you have probably been on this road if you've ever been to Chicago or Fort Myers, because US 41, which is Lakeshore Drive, and is also the main drag in Fort Myers, is actually the Dixie Highway. And I went to school at Miami, at Barry University in Miami Shores, Florida, and I would take Dixie Highway to get to school. So the road is still there. The route, I should say, is still there. But I-75, of course, is how everybody travels because it's so much faster. But given how bad the traffic is in Atlanta, all these times I drive to Florida, like Van Fest in February, maybe I'll spend some time on the Dixie Highway. We'll see. You can still find roads calling it Dixie Highway in Georgia and Kentucky as well. Now, here's a real early one. This is the Yellowstone Trail. It was one of the first roads that the Good Roads Project started. And this was done by locals. So Yellowstone had become a national park, but it was very rural. I mean, it was not an easy place to get to. And so people started thinking, well, how can we get people here? And then the Good Roads Project said, let's make a road. This road connected Plymouth Rock, specifically in Massachusetts. It connected a specific rock all the way to Puget Sound in Washington State, and it went through Yellowstone. And all the towns along the route would paint yellow circles on the rocks and posts so people would know that they were on the way to Yellowstone. And this road largely still exists. It's basically US 10 and I-90. And some of the branding is starting to come back. So if you're ever driving on I-90 and US 10 up there, up in the upper western Middle West, I guess, you may be seeing some of that there. That's the Yellowstone Trail that you're traveling on. Number six is arguably the oldest. I mean, if you think about where roads come from in the US, if you're from, like, the West, most of those roads, you just say, oh, well, they built this development in the 1940s, and they built roads here. But if you're from the East or the deep Southwest where the Spanish were, these roads may be thousands and thousands of years old. I mean, the streets of Boston are where they are because those are where people were walking 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And the deer walk, and the native folks followed the deer, and then the colonists came and then used those same trails, and then, you know, you see how this goes. And the Spanish Trail is one of the oldest examples of this. This one, which was started as early as 1910, actually ran from St. Augustine, Florida, way up in the northeastern part of Florida, all the way to San Diego, and it linked all the historic Spanish colonial cities of the South, which is why it's called the Spanish Trail. It goes through Florida, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, and the folks who built this tried to make it as elaborate as possible, as encouraging as possible. They built guidebooks, and, well, I-10 basically absorbed all of this road. Although you can still see a little bit of it in the Texas Hill Country along the Gulf Coast, and you will still see some markers and bridges, but that's the Old Spanish Trail. Now, this is the Old Spanish Trail, the highway. There's another Old Spanish Trail that you'll see referenced. Number 7, the National Old Trails Road, started in 1912. This east-west went from Baltimore to Los Angeles, going through Missouri, Kansas, and New Mexico, but it followed the Old National Road and the Santa Fe Trail. So it was marketed as a road built on history, and it later became US 40 and US 66. That was the start of US 66. And parts of it survive in Missouri and Arizona, often marked by Daughters of the American Revolution, Madonna of the Trail statues, which was kind of their symbol. That one is super old, and if you do travel Route 66, you will, by necessity, be on the National Old Trails Road as well. Number 8, the Jefferson Highway, nicknamed the Pine to Palm Highway, ran from Winnipeg, Canada to New Orleans, Louisiana. It carried lumber and agricultural traffic to connected prairie towns with the Gulf. You can still see it in Iowa, Oklahoma, Louisiana, and it is marked with a JH sign. So if you've ever driven and seen a JH sign, especially near US 71 and I-35, you are probably on the Jefferson Highway. And as the U.S. was being built up, the hunger for lumber cannot be overstated. The entire state of Vermont was basically flattened. Every tree they could grab, they grabbed. And the Green Mountains of Vermont weren't green because of the trees, they were green because of the grass that grew where the trees used to be and fed sheep. And as they ran out of that lumber, well, they started to get it from Canada. And up until recently, anyway, we used to get a lot of our lumber from Canada. Number 9, the Victory Highway, 1921, called that because it was the end of World War I. Yay, victory. This one ran, again, from New York to San Francisco, and it was considered a memorial highway. It was supposed to be an updated version or a better version of the Lincoln Highway, but it never quite made it there. And then eventually, most of it became US 40, which is also where what happened to US 66. But it went through Pennsylvania, Kansas, and Utah. This one is very much forgotten. The name has almost vanished. There are a few Victory Highway markers you can see in California and Nevada, but this road was more aspirational than actual. And number 10, the Meridian Highway. And this is an early highway, and it ran north-south from Winnipeg, Canada, to Laredo, Texas, and then into Mexico. So this one actually connected Canada with Mexico. And, well, what happened to it? It became US 81. And this road was interesting because it just simply followed the railroads. The railroads had already made all the cuts and made the route, so they basically built the road next to the railroad. And it was mostly for trade and migration, for moving people. This wasn't really a tourist road. Today, it's mostly I-35, but in some parts of Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas, you can still find signs that say Old Meridian Highway. And, you know, that's kind of cool. So, look, there's a lot of roads out there, and we've just talked about the U.S. I'm sure we could find similar roads in other countries, but I have encountered these signs out there, and I thought, well, this is interesting. And so, hey, if you're looking for a place to get your kicks, maybe not Route 66. Maybe try one of these other ones and see what you see. See how many old buildings you can see that are now something else. You know, maybe that old barber shop there was actually a gas station at one time for all this new traffic as the country became industrialized. Thank you to everyone who has visited buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Because of you, there are no ads in this podcast, which everybody appreciates. If you would like to help contribute to the built-to-go phenomenon, well, actually, if you'd like to give me a little money, I can keep ads off the podcast, and everybody likes that. And if you're interested in doing that, visit buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. And everybody will appreciate it, and thank you especially to the folks who donate every month. We are going to skip the news this week because this has been a week of bad news and I'm done with it. So we're going to move right on to Tech Talk. So I am working on this truck camper now. The wrens, this is a big wren update. The wrens have fledged and have moved out, and they are now living their wren lives out there in the woods somewhere where they belong. I can actually hear them. Carolina wrens are very vocal birds, and I can hear them calling to each other out there, so they're doing just fine. The nest itself, which they do not reuse, wrens do not reuse their nests from what I understand, they always build a new nest. There was one egg still in it that didn't hatch, so they had one bad egg, but they did at least get a couple of chillins out of it, and they're out there flying around right now. But this meant I could get back into the truck camper, and it kind of put me in a difficult situation in a weird way, because I've changed my plans so often this summer that I didn't know what to do, because last week I talked about that cap I got. I was all geared up to get that thing ready to go to Colorado with, and then suddenly now I can get back in the truck camper, and I have to finish the truck camper so that more birds don't move in there. I at least have to close the floors up, and so that's what I've been working on this past weekend. If you've never seen a truck camper up close, there's a weird thing about them, and almost all of them are like this, and it's that the propane lines run outside the camper. They're copper lines, and they're not in the camper. They run right outside all the way around the base of the camper. And so this camper has a refrigerator, a stove, a water heater, and a furnace. So I've got four connections that come out and then run around the camper. And because I had to replace all that rotten wood, I had to undo those connections to get them out of the way so I could put the new wood up. And then I drilled holes and hooked up all the pipes again. And then I figured, okay, I'm going to turn on the gas and there's going to be leaks and I'm going to have to mess around with them, because that's just how it is, especially when you're plumbing with propane. This is one of those things that you should have a professional do. I used to be a certified propane tank refiller person when I lived in Utah, so I'm fairly comfortable with this stuff. But anyway, I expected to have some leaks. I go and I turn on the tank and I get my little bubble wand of stuff to detect leaks, and no leaks. I did it perfect, which is amazing. I was really shocked that I didn't have to tweak anything. And so then I go around and test the devices. So I've got to test the refrigerator. Okay, I turn on the refrigerator, and it's an absorption fridge like we talked about before, and it has a setting for propane, and I watch the lights, and yes, it lights up. The plate gets cool in the freezer. That works. Go to the stove, turn on the burners, light them. Nice blue flames. Everything's good there. I can't test the water heater because I haven't finished the water system yet. That there's some really weird stuff growing in the tank that I got to deal with. So that leaves the furnace. Now, on this trip to Colorado that I'm hoping to do next week, I may be out in Colorado when you're listening to this. We don't know yet. I will probably use the furnace because it's going to get fairly cold. So I definitely want the furnace to work. So this is an Atwood propane furnace, 12,000 BTU, I think. It's probably the smallest one they make, but a very standard kind of RV furnace with a sail switch and thermocouple and all that. It's got a control board, though, so it's, modern-ish. And a thermostat on the wall that has on-off, and you set the temperature. So I crank the temperature up as high as it'll go and turn it on, and I hear, air coming. The thing has power. It started. Then I hear the... And... Nope, nothing. Then I hear nothing. I'm like, okay, there's probably air in the lines. I'm going to wait. And then nothing. And then it shuts off. I'm like, okay, well, I have an ignition lockout. So these furnaces have a control board that will basically shut them off if they don't light in a certain amount of tries, which is a safety thing, because the furnace is like, I don't know what's going on, but since gas is dangerous, I'm going to shut everything down, which is fine. Unfortunately, the way this thing is installed, I have to take everything apart to see the control board, because on the control board, there's a red light that blinks and tells you what the problem is. So I unscrew a bunch of stuff and ruin all this lovely sealing bead that's around this panel that I have to remove, and I have to pull out the furnace pipe, and anyway, it was a mess. And sure enough, there's mud dauber wasps living in the exhaust pipe, which is not unusual. It didn't surprise me. They were not living there anymore. They had just left the remains. So I cleaned that out. Not a big deal. And then I try again, and I watch this time, and then, sure enough, after it fails on the third try, this red light starts blinking. It blinks three times, and written right on the control board is what I thought. It's an ignition lockout. Ignition lockout sounds scary, but it's actually kind of a generic message. There are other codes that would mean specific things. This one doesn't tell you anything specific. It just says, hey, I tried three times, and it doesn't work. So when you're troubleshooting a furnace or a refrigerator, which at this point are basically the same thing, you have to understand how the system works. And it's pretty simple. I'm going to tell you right now, you're going to be a propane expert here very shortly. You turn on the propane tank very slowly because the new tanks have a lockout mechanism themselves. That'll trip you up. I had to check that and that was fine. But you turn it on very slowly. Gas flows out of the tank. Okay. Gas goes down the pipe and it gets to the furnace. When it gets to the furnace, it stops because there's a valve in the furnace that turns the gas on and off. As you may have guessed, the thermostat is the thing that controls this valve. When the thermostat says, hey, send me heat, an electrical signal goes to the control board, and the control board opens a solenoid, and that lets the gas flow in. When the gas flows in, the igniter, which is actually just two metal electrodes that have a spark between them, it turns on. That's that clicking noise. And it's supposed to light, at which point you'll hear a, you know, you hear like a burning sound, and then you know you're okay. And yes, there's a fan here too, obviously. There's a fan that's blowing, but that's not part of this issue. So everything was right. I heard everything, except it wasn't lighting. Now, normally, and I've dealt with many furnaces and many water heaters, normally when it doesn't light, the problem is either the thermocouple, which is a safety device that if it doesn't stay hot, it'll turn the gas off, or there's an orifice that's blocked with something, which is actually the problem Yogi and I had with her scamp. So, again, I got to take a whole bunch of stuff apart to get at this. So I, at this point, I'm literally taking the entire furnace apart. I've got pieces of it lying everywhere, trying to remember which screw goes where. And this thing's clean. It was beautiful inside. I mean, yeah, we had there was the wasps in the exhaust, but the burner looked beautiful. And I watched the spark, and it was a nice spark. And this doesn't make sense. And then I noticed something. I wasn't smelling any gas because, theoretically, if this thing had tried to start a few times and didn't, there should be some gas somewhere, and I should smell it. So, that was odd, but in order to test that, I'm going to take the gas line off again, which I really didn't want to do, but okay, fine. I'm getting annoyed. I take off the gas line, and as I'm halfway done unscrewing it, I realize I forgot to turn the tank off, so I'm taking off a live gas line, this is why you should have professionals do this, but nothing's happening. Like, there was no gas coming out. Now, this is strange. Of all the troubleshooting I've done on all the different propane systems and all the different rigs I've had, I've never had anything like this. So I'm like, there must be a valve I'm missing somewhere, because there should be gas coming out. And so I'm going to tell you this. This is one of those absolutely do not ever do this, even though I did it thing. My hand over to the end of the pipe, and it felt a little tiny bit cold, but there clearly wasn't a big whoosh of gas coming out. And I lit a match and put it at the end of the pipe. Now, I prepared for it to just act like a blowtorch, but it didn't. However, it did something really weird. It lit just a little bit, like I lit a candle. That told me that some gas was getting through this pipe, but not anywhere near as much as it should be. And after all, the furnace is the hungriest gas device in the whole thing. And I thought, oh no, I must have bent a pipe, because I had taken all these copper pipes apart. I figured I bent one, it was crimped. So I took the entire line out completely, from the manifold that was created that distributes the gas to the different appliances, all the way to the furnace. I actually took it out of the camper entirely, held it in my hands, and nothing was pinched. It was exactly like it should be. So what the heck is going on here? And then I thought, oh, the wrens. Now, I didn't mean that the wrens had anything directly to do with this. What I meant was, the wrens interrupted me. So I was working on this thing, and then the Wrens moved in and I had to stop. But I left the gas lines unhooked up outside. And what is a gas line that's not hooked up? It's a little hole, exactly the right size for a wasp. There are wasps that fly around and look for holes this size and will go inside and build a cap. And then, believe it or not, they fill it with spiders. That's what you see when you see wasps flitting about. They're often looking for spiders. Fill it with spiders, lay an egg, cap it off. Now, usually they do this fairly close to the opening of the hole, and I couldn't see this on either end, but this was my theory. So I blew some air in there. I blew it like a trumpet, except it didn't make any noise and I couldn't get any air to come out. At that point, I knew that I had a problem. So I grabbed one of those flags. They're little wire flags. If you've ever been on a farm, a working farm, they've got billions of them. They're just little flags you stick in the ground that mark things. And a lot of people, at least me and farmers, have these not so much because of their flags, but because they're nice thin wires. And I took one of those and I stuffed it down the pipe on both ends, but it wasn't really long enough to do the whole pipe. And then I was like, all right, fine. So I took it over to the water barrel because I don't have running water here. I just collect rainwater. And filled it up with water, and then sure enough, out comes a cap, and what at one time were spiders. They didn't look like that now. And then some sort of insect debris. And yeah, wasps had moved in there and blocked the gas in the line, and that's why my furnace didn't work. And that is definitely not on the Atwood troubleshooting guide of things to check. So, my advice to you, if you're troubleshooting something and nothing makes sense, is to break things down even further. This is especially true for electrical things. I have had electrical wires break inside the insulation. So you can see it's connected here, and it's connected here, and there's power at one end and not power at the other end. How can that be? It doesn't make any sense. I promise you the laws of physics have not been broken. You just need to go back further and deeper and figure out exactly what it is. Test it with a different wire or pipe, or figure out why something's not getting from one end to the other. And in my case, it was either a pinch, which there weren't any, or a blockage. What was the most likely blockage? Oh yeah, I'm in the woods. It was a wasp. So the wasp is gone. And now I have a furnace that works in my truck camper. And that was 2 hours to do something I thought was going to take 2 minutes. Product review. So one of the things I want to do as I'm repairing this truck camper is waterproof the underneath of the wings, which are the sides that hang over the truck. When it was originally built, they just used like this paper that covered plywood, and that was it. Now, that area doesn't get very wet. It's because it's on the bottom, and I suppose stuff could spray up from the wheels or something, but it's not an area that gets all that wet. It doesn't ever sit in water unless you have a problem. But still, given all the water damage this thing has had, and I'm just using wood planks to replace the bottoms, I wanted to cover it with something better than Cuprinol, you know, or Thompson's Water Seal, something pretty substantial. So I bought a can of this Gorilla Rubber Spray. It's basically Flex Seal, but it's made by Gorilla, which, in my experience, Gorilla has been a pretty good brand. I like their tapes. Their double-sided tape's not so good, but their regular gaffer's tape is good, and their glues are pretty good. So I thought, all right, we'll give them a try. It was a little cheaper than the Flex Seal. And I did a test, and I sprayed a whole bunch underneath one side. And I didn't do the whole thing. I just wanted to see what it would do and let it dry. And I have to tell you, this stuff is pretty good. It made this nice, smooth, non-sticky coating that it's actually a bit like Plasti-Dip, if you've ever used that, where you dip the tool handle in there and it covers it with the plastic. It's not quite that same texture, but it's similar. And I'm going to be able to cover everything I need to cover with just one can. The coverage is great. So right now, and I haven't, seen this thing through a winter or not yet, right now this stuff is pretty good if you want to rubberize something, like maybe a bumper or some metal component that's constantly getting sprayed with salt water or whatever, and the spray paint's not enough. You want to make it a little bit better. And now it doesn't really have any grippy texture. Like, it's not going to help you like make your stairs less slippery or anything like that. So that's not a good use for it, unless you maybe threw sand on it while it was wet. That might help. But it's good for kind of encapsulating something and having it be waterproof. Now, one tip with this, it is not precise at all. It's less precise than a spray can. You have to be a fair distance away for it to get properly applied, else it'll create sags and bubbles and stuff like that. Yeah, I found that out the hard way. So when you're using this, make sure you mask off a very wide area because it'll get on everything. And then what happens? Well, as it happened, my phone fell out of my pocket as I was spraying, and it actually, the stuff got on the screen of my phone, which I'm just about to trade in. It's got to be in as good condition as possible, and now it's covered in Gorilla rubber spray. But the good news is it's scraped right off. I was able to get it off, and it's fine. So the stuff will scrape off, but I think, from what I can tell, it has adhered to that bare wood really, really well, and now I'm going to have a very nice coating under there that I'm not going to have to worry about, and it will also provide some protection against like rock chips and stuff like that. So it's early, but I like the stuff. I think I'm going to consider using it on other applications I have to think about, but just another arrow for your quiver of things that you might need for some specific application. I've got a link in the show notes. It's officially called Gorilla Waterproof Patch and Seal Rubberized Sealant Spray, and it comes in three colors: black, clear, and white. It's very similar to Flex Seal, but it seems tougher somehow. And, well, I'll give you a report over time to see if that bears out. Tales from the Road. Oh boy, do I have a tale for you. I bought that truck cap that I talked about last week, and I didn't have jacks for it, and I needed to take it off the truck because the pads, the rubber pads that are under it, aren't the right shape, and I need to trim them and stuff, and I want to be able to take it off the truck anyway. So the problem is, I found out that it uses a type of jack that isn't made anymore. It's a camper jack, a truck camper jack, but it has these blades that stick into the side. There's like slots for the blades of these things, and Space Cap brand uses this system too, or at least used to, but nobody uses it anymore. And Rico, the company that made these, doesn't make them anymore. So I was kind of screwed because no matter what, I needed to take the cap off of my truck so that I can go to Colorado, because either I'm going to put the truck camper in there, I'm going to put the cap back or something, but I needed to get that out of there to fix those pads because it was sitting in there kind of cockeyed. So what do you do? Well, I'm looking for a product that isn't made anymore, that I'm never going to find locally. Oh, but wait, my Facebook Marketplace addiction. So I go onto Facebook Marketplace, and I search, and it's a difficult thing to search for, because people don't know what these are, what do you call them, and I'm looking and looking, and I see, sitting on a pallet in some farmer's yard, three of these jacks. I need four, but there's three, and he was only asking $25 for all three. And it was 86 miles away. So I'm like, yep, I'm going to take this opportunity. It's going to be a 2-hour drive down, a 2-hour drive back. It doesn't matter. I'm doing it. And I did. I got in touch with the guy, and he said, yeah, come on down and pick him up. Gave him the $25. Super nice guy. Loaded them in the truck. But as I'm driving, and it was a beautiful drive, I'm at this property that is on the Illinois River, and the route to Littleton, Illinois, which is where I went, basically followed the river. So I got to see all kinds of beautiful views of the river and all kinds of birds, lots of pelicans and egrets, and I even saw some stilts, which is a fairly rare bird. Just a nice day. Nice time of year, a little bit pre-fall, just a hint of color. It was a good trip. I liked it. But as I got close, I started to notice something. Now, if you know anything about Illinois, you know that Illinois is flat. Illinois is the second flattest state in the country. And so living here, I notice when things aren't flat. And I started to see these hills, these very rounded hills. And my first thought was, huh, I wonder if these are terminal moraines. Terminal moraines are where a glacier stopped and left all the dirt it was pushing like right there. So the glacier comes down and then stops, and all the dirt it was pushing is just made into like this hill and stays there. And they're not uncommon in this region at all. So I thought, oh, this must be the terminal moraine region. And then I started noticing that the hills had shapes, and they were not like effigy mounds, but they were rounded, like they were man-made. And I thought, over time, people could have, you know, cut these and stuff. But I was a little curious about it, and I thought, when I get home, I'll look it up and see what's down here. But I didn't have to, because I saw a sign that said Dickson Mounds Museum. That's D-I-C-K-S-O-N-S Mounds Museum. And I was like, oh, these are what we called Indian mounds or native mounds. And if you've not encountered these things, if these mounds were built by early peoples in what is now the United States, you would never say they were built by the Choctaw or the Potawatomi or anything like that, because the people who built these predate those groups of people. They're before them. Now, they're not way, way back like Clovis or Red Ochre, we don't think, but early Mississippian, the primitive era, the Woodlands era, they have all these time periods, and I am not an archaeologist or anthropologist, so I'm probably screwing this up. But at any rate, these things were built by people sometimes over 1,000 years ago. These big, big mounds built with just baskets of dirt that they would dig and dump and dig and dump over years and years and years. And why they did this is up for conjecture, but a lot of them were built near rivers. And the idea is that when the floodwaters come, all their important structures are out of the floodwater. I mean, that's kind of the thought. The largest of these is called Cahokia. It is in East St. Louis, Illinois. And it's a gigantic pyramid. In fact, you'd think it was just it's not quite a mountain, but a hill, except it was actually man-made. And Cahokia is famous. This complex that I had stumbled across was around the same time as Cahokia, but maybe not related, although they do know there was trade between the sites. Believe it or not, all that is not the story. On the way back, I thought, well, I drove all the way down here. I might as well go see the museum. And I'm thinking, all right, this is going to be some little tiny museum. It's probably not going to be open. So I look on Google, and sure enough, it is open. I was like, okay, so it's only a few miles away. And as I'm driving up to this museum, I'm like, what is this place? First off, it's built on one of these mounds, one of the really big mounds. And the building itself is shaped like a pyramid, and it's huge. This is a massive building. It's like the size of a hotel. And I thought, this is an awfully elaborate museum. I mean, this building is bigger than the museum they have at Cahokia. What is going on here? And I drive up the winding hill to this museum, and there's this massive parking lot. One way to judge the size of a parking lot is how many handicapped spaces they have. This one had 10. There was at least 100 stalls in this parking lot. Massive complex, and I've never, ever heard of this place, which for me is a little weird. And then I start observing things. For example, the parking lot, while being huge, has not been well maintained. There's grass growing up through the broken concrete. And I'm like, this almost looks like it was a place, but is it even open anymore? I mean, Google said it was. So there were a couple of cars in the parking lot, but they were in weird places. They weren't by the door. And I realized later that they were where the shade was going to be at the end of the day, which told me that those cars belonged to the employees who had learned to park their cars there. So at the end of the day, their cars wouldn't be so hot. Very clever. So there's people. So, okay. So I go in, and as I'm walking towards the building on my left, there's this very strange octagonal structure that looks like it's from Morocco. It has this onion dome on it, and it's pretty big. It's probably 500 or 600 square feet inside. And I'm like, what is that? There's no signs. I had stepped into another dimension. And the shape of this building was like a pyramid. It was brown, covered with that pebble stone stuff. And it went up. It was like a pyramid with the top cut off. And at the very top, there were windows. And I learned later there were 3 floors. I was astonished that this thing could exist in Illinois and I would know about it. And so I go through the door, and it's just a regular museum. There's some displays and dioramas talking about the local native populations, and there's a guy sitting behind the front desk, and I go up and say, hey, I just stumbled across this place. This is amazing. I'd like to visit. What's admission? He says it's free. And I'm like, well, that's great. And so instead of admission, I'll give you a donation. They had a little donation box there, and I toss some money in there. And he said, go up to the third floor, take the elevator or the stairs, and then work your way down. Because if you start at the bottom, you'll start in the 19th century and it won't make any sense. I thought, okay. So I go up to the third floor and the elevator door opens and I am in a museum and there's a big diorama of native folks fishing, and I have pictures in the show notes you can see. I'll put in a few more than normal, but it's a very nice museum. I'm learning about the people who live there, and there's a river nearby called the Spoon River. Why is it called the Spoon River? It's because there were mussels there, mussel shells. You know, if you're not, they're like clams, but back then they were much bigger, and people would use them as spoons. And this river had a lot of them, therefore it was the Spoon River. That's where you went to get your spoons from, which I thought was pretty cool. But I'm learning stuff, and then I'm starting to notice a pattern. Most of the cases are empty. The display cases, there's just like nothing in them. There's like pins and holders for where things used to be, and there's signs, but the objects are gone. And I'm just like, what is this place and what is going on? And then I find a case that has an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper pasted to it. And it says, why are some objects missing? And I'm going to read you verbatim what's written on the sign. It said, Dixon Mounds Museum and Illinois State Museum staff have removed funerary objects from display at the request of our tribal partners. These artifacts are part of ongoing consultations with federally recognized tribal nations under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, NAGPRA. The artifacts you see remaining were not found in burials and or are reproductions, and tribal permission has been granted for these items to be displayed. Well, isn't that interesting? And so I'm thinking, oh, okay, this is an interesting negotiation, and there's a whole big philosophical thing I could go into here about what is the purpose of museums, and do you honor your culture by reburying these objects or by using them for education? There's a whole lot of stuff to talk about here. But that is not my role right here, right now. My role here right now is to tell you what I saw. And the more I walked around, the more of these signs I encountered. And I realized that like 85% of the objects in this museum had been removed. And then twice I encountered these doors. And these were automatic timed double doors. Like they opened for a feature. Like if you ever go to Disney property, you'll see they have these doors that open automatically when the ride's done. It was like that, but they were closed, and there were several of them. And I started to notice that, you know, this place was not all that well maintained. It looked like they were having budget problems. There were some sagging tiles, and anyway, this is not unusual. State budgets are hard. So I make my way around. I don't see any other people. I go through the exhibits and I go down, and basically the only things left are the things on the walls that are like dioramas of things and a few little objects here and there. And I get to the bottom floor, and sure enough, there's all the colonial stuff, you know, the pioneers and the log house and all that. And I'm, yeah, okay, that's fine. But at this point, I didn't come here to spend hours. This was something I just saw on the side of the road. And so as I'm walking out, I asked the person at the front desk, who's a different person now. I say, this is a strange and challenging place. I'm curious about something. If the objects were removed, which I understand, that's fine. That's a negotiation. You know, I'm not complaining about that. But why wouldn't the curator put pictures of the objects or moldings of the objects or something like that in place? And the woman seemed offended by that question and gave me a very curt, rehearsed answer that was basically the sign I had read earlier. And when I tried to get a little bit more information, I was completely cut off. I was like, there's something going on here. But through all this, I had made an assumption. I had assumed that these artifacts were removed recently. When I asked them, they said, well, the displays are from the 90s, and well, why don't we're thinking maybe we should just do something new instead of just replacing those missing artifacts with pictures or something. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. What I didn't know is that they've all been missing And the doors to the burial chamber have been closed since 1992. 33 years this museum has existed in this current state with basically no artifacts. It's not true, there's some, but most of the artifacts gone. The cafe is closed. There's no gift shop, which, you know, not that I need a gift shop for everything, but that's kind of weird. 33 years this place has been in limbo. And I said, I'm sorry, just one other question. There's this odd Moroccan looking building in the parking lot. What is that? And she said, oh, that's the Canton toll booth. And I'm like, well, it doesn't have any signs on it or anything. So what's a Canton toll booth? And there was another person there at that time, and they both looked at each other. And the guy standing there said, oh, I forgot to open it. Come with me. So he escorts me outside, because apparently this building's supposed to be open, and you can go inside and learn what it is. So, okay, I'm all about that. But on the way out, I'm saying, I ask, like, you know, what's the future of the building here? What's going on? And, you know, he starts to tell me the story that, yes, they have budget problems, but also they had a director who interfaced with the local tribal communities and basically gave them everything they wanted. And then, you know, there was this act that was passed in 1990 and all this. And then he asked me, where are you from? And I said, oh, well, I live in Chicago, but I have a place on the up the river from here. And his demeanor changed instantly. And I have learned in my travels that that question is a bit of a trap. Not all the time. Sometimes people are just curious. But several times when I've answered Chicago, I've seen people's demeanor change. And that's not a good thing. And it happened here. But I didn't stop. I kept asking him some questions, and basically I got the idea, and this was not an old guy, this guy was in his 30s probably, that he was very upset at the fact that the museum had given up all their artifacts. Now, this whole museum started in the 1920s because the hill was owned by a chiropractor and he was putting in an orchard. And as he was digging up the land for the orchard, he kept finding bones and stuff. So he gave up on the orchard, and being an amateur, he actually did a really good job of this, but he excavated the whole site and he left all these skeletons that he found right where they were and kind of dug around them. So they ended up like on pedestals, and he found all these beads and other objects buried with the bodies, and he turned it into a museum. And then gradually it became a roadside attraction. Great Depression happened. He sells it to the state. State buys it. And eventually, as I learned later, the state spends nearly $2 million building this massive museum right on top of the museum he had made. So when I mentioned this to the guy, I have an issue with chiropractors. I'll come clear about that. And I said something a little bit derogatory about it. And the guy seemed like he was defending the chiropractor. Like he was in favor of what the guy was doing. But he was done with me. Once I said Chicago, he wanted to have nothing to do with me. So he opened the door and he said, okay, Canton toll booth, have fun. And he walked away very abruptly, which I thought was odd because I was literally the only person there. I don't know what's going on. So this Canton toll booth, just really briefly, was a toll booth created in 1860 for a plank road, which is, in this part of the country, there's a lot of clay and roads get very muddy if they're not paved. And what they would do is literally cover the road with wooden planks, but that cost money, so they put up toll booths, so if people used it, they'd have to pay. And this was one of those toll booths for this road that went from Canton, Illinois, to some other town. Side, so that's there, but that's not what we're talking about. Okay, so let me tell you the rest of the story as I can, and this is so huge, and I've already gone long, and I apologize, but I have encountered this amazingly huge story here. As I understand it, this guy builds this museum, this chiropractor guy, is full of dead bodies, you know, dozens of skeletons, all very well preserved. He did a good job for an amateur. State buys it, realizes this is a cool thing. It's a big tourist attraction, and builds this massive museum over it in 1972, and the place is very popular. The reason the parking lot's so big is because so many people went there. So this is a big deal. they had a Lincoln Douglas debate there. 1,000 people came, and I went and saw. They had this big amphitheater built that was beautiful. I mean, you could have had rock concerts here. Now it's all in decay. But then they got into fights with the local groups, the local native groups, who were like, this is disrespectful of our ancestors. So in their culture, once you're buried, you stay buried. And people shouldn't be looking at your bones. There shouldn't be pictures of your bones. None of that. And I was in this weird place where I didn't know all this history. And I'm touring the museum. And the people there thought I already knew all this stuff. So it was a weird, weird vibe. But now, having seen pictures of what the original place looked like, I see the issue. It's like this. Imagine you have Disneyland, and then someone objects to things that move. I know it's crazy, but just stick with me here. And they say, Disneyland's fine, it can stay open, but nothing can move. You can keep all the rides, but nothing can move. Would anybody go? I mean, would you go on Space Mountain if the roller coaster didn't go anywhere? This is like that. Once those artifacts were removed and once the burial room was closed, which is what was behind those doors that I couldn't get in, people stopped coming and the state stopped funding it. And now it's got like this skeleton crew in this massive, really architecturally interesting building that's sadly falling apart. What a crazy thing. And what a weird thing to think about, where I generally think of museums as a good thing. But would I think a museum was a good thing if it were displaying my grandmother's bones and all the things that were in her kitchen? For me personally, I'm not sure I would say no to that. That might be okay, but there's more than one culture in the world. And for these folks, they see these folks as their ancestors who are being disrespected. And thus, there's this major conflict. I'll leave you with one last thing, and there's a whole ton more. It's so big of a topic, I can't possibly fit it into the short segment. I saw other things as well. The last thing the guy said to me before he bid me adieu and left was, let me put it this way. There'll never be another white event here ever again. What does that mean? What is a white event? And all I can look at is newspaper articles back from 1990 when all this was going on. And it seemed like there's this huge division between the tribes and the local white people who this was bringing money into their economy. And they saw things differently. So it's still being maintained by the state. It's still owned by the state, but it's getting the very minimal amount of funding needed just to keep the lights on. And eventually they're going to have to close it because the building is starting to lose paneling. And as soon as water gets in there and is unchecked, that's going to be the end of it. But still kind of an interesting place to visit, even though it's mostly empty. Boy, you go out there on the road, you never know what you're going to find. But this was a fascinating place, and should you visit it? I put this as Tales to the Road instead of a place to visit, because I'm not sure you should. But if you're curious about the meta of museums, like maybe let's face it here, this is not a good museum. All the exhibits are empty, or most of them. And the dig sites that they have on the property that you can visit have not seen any maintenance in years. The lights are out. They're full of dead spiders. I mean, it's still interesting. And if you're an archaeology student, you'll see fascinating stuff here. I mean, there's one of a kind stuff here that's amazing. But for most people, they're going to be terribly disappointed at this museum. And I think that's what caused the attitude that I encountered. So anyway, it's Dixon Mounds Museum. It's in Littleton, Illinois. I'll have a link in the show notes. I'll put more pictures up than usual so you can see some of the stuff. But what a very, very strange afternoon that was. A place to visit. So, if you want to go see a place that's exactly on the other end of things, there is one in Illinois called the Volo Museum. It's actually a whole complex. Volo, V-O-L-O. It's in Volo, Illinois. And if main attraction there is a car museum, and they specialize in movie cars. So if you want to go see the DeLorean from Back to the Future, if you want to go see all the different Batmobiles, the original Ghostbusters mobile, all those kind of things, they have them all there, and you can take your picture in front of them and see them and stuff, and it's kind of fun. They have all kinds of classic cars, some weird cars. They have a big collection of 1950s and 60s fiberglass boats that look like spaceships. There's a lot of cool stuff to see here. And it's a whole complex that people in Illinois, you know, this is a place people in Illinois know about, but the rest of the world doesn't. They have Jurassic Gardens, which is gardens filled with life-size dinosaurs. They have a Titanic exhibit. They have a train ride. They have an antique mall. There's a whole bunch of stuff here. It's your classic roadside attraction, but it has been kept up and modernized, and it has something for everyone. Now, let's be very clear here. All those cars are reproductions. It's not the original stuff. This is a place to go have fun. It is not a museum in the sense that you're going to learn things about history. That's not its point. Its point is to show you fun things and for you to have a good time. Very, very different than either version of Dixon Mounds Museum. And I had a good time here. I took it properly. I did not expect to go to the Smithsonian. I expected to go to just kind of a fun place, and it was that. The Military Museum was actually kind of interesting. It's older, and sometimes I like the older museums because I like to see how they did the exhibits back then, and they did these dioramas of different World War, like a World War I medical tent, for example, or then a World War II gun emplacement. You know, I found it kind of interesting. Now, this is not too far from Chicago, and if you're looking to do something a little bit different, this is a place worth checking out, I think. But again, do not expect the Smithsonian. Think more amusement park in the form of a museum. It's officially called the Volo Auto Museum in Volo, Illinois. And I will have a link in the show notes. Okay, I'm going really long on this one. I apologize. I've just had a lot of crazy story happening lately. But I do want to do a resource recommendation. Resource recommendation for you. Very quickly, it's called TripIt. This is a program that's been around a long time. It's an app, works on the web too. It used to be better. It's not as good anymore because it got bought out by Concur, some big corporate entity. But this thing's really excellent ability is to keep track of your details for trips. Now, van life isn't really like this, but if you're doing trips that involve plane flights and hotels and things like that, it can get really confusing really fast. With this program, all you do is you forward email reservations to this email address, and it puts them all in a timeline in the app and on the website. And I love that because it shows me any conflicts I might have. The way it groups things, it groups them by day. And you might say, well, wait, my plane lands on this day. My hotel doesn't start till this day. I must have screwed up a date or something. It's very, very good for that. It will check for flight delays and things like that. And that's all free. Now, for $50 a year, you get some extra features. For example, it will continually check the prices of the flights. And if the price goes down, it will tell you how to initiate a refund. And every year I have had this app, I have been able to get my $50 back that way. It's doing work that I simply wouldn't have done. Now, it used to be more powerful. Concur has kind of toned it down a bit, which makes me sad. But I still find it useful, and I've tried a whole bunch of the other trip organizing apps, and it's still the one they end up going to. So it's at tripit.com. I've got a link in the show notes. Might as well try out the free version. And if you're planning complicated trips, it might be a lifesaver. One caveat, though, it doesn't like the format of all reservations, so sometimes you have to go in and do things manually. And my fear is that for van life folks, where our plans are so manual, like, you know, find a place to sleep near this attraction, you know, maybe the Cracker Barrel, it's not going to do any of that automatically. You're going to have to put it in yourself. But it's still a very simple, easy way to keep track of everything so you know that you're covered and you've done everything you need to. Well, folks, thank you once again for listening to Built to Go. This was so much story. I had so much story this week. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And if you need to get a hold of me for any reason, I am Jeff at builttogo.com. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. Until next time, remember the words of Simon Bolivar. do something right, it must be done twice. The first time instructs the second.